Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump's executive orders to revive the Keystone XL pipeline that was rejected by Obama, and the Dakota Access Pipeline that was stalled by the Army Corps of Engineers because of protests from the Standing Rock Sioux. Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, joins us to discuss the broader issues involved in the reversal of energy policies to deal with climate change from global warming. With Trump's installation of global warming deniers in his cabinet, we'll look into the choice of an oil man to head up the State Department, Rex Tillerson, who previously made a deal with Putin for Exxon to extract Russian Arctic oil because the melting of the ice caps due to global warming was making it more economical to do so, and assess the extent to which handing over the environment to big oil will reinforce the cycle of burning fossil fuels, which contributes to global warming and in effect enables dying industries to profit from the planet's destruction they are accelerating. Then we'll examine whether Trump's America First approach to threatening tariffs and the tearing up the TPP and NAFTA will bring back jobs when other factors beyond globalization, such as robotics and the rise of the dollar, are at work. Jared Bernstein, a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and the former chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, joins us. We will discuss his article at the New York Times, Ditching the TPP Won't Solve the Trade Deficit, and whether Trump, who has argued that American workers are paid too much and that unions are responsible for jobs being outsourced abroad, will lose more American jobs than create new ones. Then finally, we will speak with a former FBI special agent, Colleen Rowley, and discuss Donald Trump's warm embrace of James Comey over the weekend and his decision to keep Comey on as the head of the FBI, even though Trump had criticized him earlier for finding there was no basis to prosecute Hillary Clinton over her use of a private email server. We will look into whether keeping Comey inside the tent will ensure that the investigation into the Trump campaign's alleged collusion with Russia will go nowhere. And joining us now is Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He is a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include The Hockey Stick and Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines, and his latest co-authored with Washington Post cartoonist Tom Tullis, The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Mann.
Thanks, Ian. It's always good to be with you, even during these troubling times.
Well, when you say that the subtitle of your new book, The Madhouse Effect, Driving Us Crazy, I mean, what's extraordinary is that the man in the Oval Office, the President of the United States, might well be crazy. I mean, just the other day, in the meeting of the top congressional leaders, the Big Eight or whatever they call them, Donald Trump launched into this insane diatribe how between 3 and 5 million illegal aliens voted in the election and therefore denied him the popular vote. Now, how in God's name could you ever pull off a conspiracy like that, assuming that any of it could even be remotely true? The idea that there are 5 million people who somehow can make up their IDs and show up and vote in the elections and then suddenly disappear and there's not one trace of evidence.
Well, that's right. And, you know, we've now been introduced to the world of alternative facts is now a buzzword, along with fake news. The irony is that as a climate scientist, as I tell people, we've been dealing with fake news and alternative facts for years now. We have seen the same sort of, you know, misinformation, disinformation campaign underway for years when it comes to the industry-funded attack on the science of climate change. And what's so fascinating is to now see this rise to a level where it permeates all of our public discourse. And of course, you couldn't have invented a figure who would more perfectly represent what we portended in The Madhouse Effect. The book was written before the election, before we knew the result of the election. In fact, in the galley proofs of the book, we didn't even have a cartoon about Donald Trump. We fixed that in the final version. And the cartoon that Tom Tolles did proved to be prescient. And I'll just say it involves Donald Trump and a wall and an attempt to wall ourselves off from the facts of climate change, which is what he's done. He's literally used his office thus far. In the few days that he's had, he is literally dismantling all of the progress that was made over a period of decades, really, when it comes to action to deal with climate change.
Well, but it's being done under the rubric of jobs. And it's true, if you unleash, I suppose, the extraction industries with absolutely no concern in this complete laissez-faire, non-regulatory environment, then maybe you will create some jobs, but then you'll kill the planet and then we'll have no jobs. I mean,
That's right. And if you talk to the economists, actually, again, we're dealing with alternative facts, because the true facts here are that the world is moving ahead. The rest of the world has recognized that clean energy is the future economy of this planet. And anybody who gets left out of this energy revolution is going to get left behind. So the real irony is that if we don't embrace clean energy, renewable energy, like China is, like India now is, like the rest of the world is doing, then we're going to be left behind, and we are going to suffer the consequences of having far less jobs than we would have had if we got aboard on what is, again, the great revolution of this century, the great economic revolution, the revolution of clean energy and renewable energy. You folks in California understand this. You have a governor, Jerry Brown, who's a hero of mine, who understands this. But unfortunately, even while California is moving in the right direction and many of the states are, what Trump wants to do is take us back in the wrong direction. And ironically, with his promise to make this country great, well, he's going to ensure that we cannot achieve greatness if he forces us to stay out of, again, this great economic revolution that is underway.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He, along with others, shared the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize and that other members of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And his latest book with Tom Tolles, the Washington Post cartoonist, is The Madhouse Effect: How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. But just to touch on the rubric of the jobs, this is all being done to create jobs. On Tuesday, Trump said that Keystone XL would create 28,000 jobs. But in 2014, the State Department Environmental Study said the project would create 3,900 construction jobs and 35 permanent jobs.
Right.
And then the company that's building the Dakota Access Pipeline, Energy Transfer Partners, the shares of ETP went up along with the shares of Keystone XL, they went at 3.5%. But Trump owned ETP stock through at least the mid 2016 up until the middle of last year, according to his financial disclosure forms. And the head of ETP, the chief executive, Kelsey Warren, donated $100,000 to Donald Trump's campaign. there's an example of draining the swamp, right?
Well, I mean, if you look up the term conflict of interest in the encyclopedia, there's a photo of Donald Trump now there.
Right.
We are talking about conflicts of interest that if we had seen that in any previous president, if Barack Obama had conflicts of interest even vaguely resembling what we're seeing now in the incoming administration, of course, there would have been a campaign of vilification against him. And now that the shoe's on the other foot, congressional Republicans, the Republican leadership seems to be perfectly fine with, what may be the greatest degree of corruption we have ever seen in the executive office of our country.
And it's only just beginning. But let's look into what I think is the real agendas. I think are one, Trump has delivered power to the Republicans beyond their wildest expectations, because along with everybody else, I think they assumed that Hillary Clinton would have should have won. Now, this is the dream come true for the Republicans and for the Koch brothers, and they seem to be getting their agenda entirely. And by the way, David Koch spent the evening at Trump Tower when the election results came in, along with the libertarian from Silicon Valley, Peter Thiel. So
30% of his picks, his nominees, have direct associations with the Koch brothers, the largest privately held polluting interest in the country. Yep.
So this is the reality. And they've got, then you've got Rex Tillerson, the former head of Exxon at the state.
Yes.
And Rex Tillerson made a deal with Putin for Exxon to extract Russian Arctic oil because of the melting of the ice caps due to global warming, made it more economical to do so. So here you have this extraordinary situation where you have the possibility that the last hurrah for big oil, because the rest of the world, as you point out, China and other countries, are moving on to alternative energies. Everybody knows that we've got to stop consuming fossil fuels, but big oil has come up with a windfall here. They've got this guy in the White House, and they got the Republican Party in the pocket of big oil and the Koch brothers, which are a part of the big oil network. And what they seem to be going to do is just, you know, delay the inevitable, pump like crazy, drill, baby, drill, and basically create this feedback loop where the burning of fossil fuels contribute to global warming. In effect, these dying industries will be profiting from the planet's destruction, which they are accelerating.
Now, as you alluded to earlier, this is being done under the guise of promising more jobs, but in fact, the number of jobs associated, permanent jobs associated with the Keystone XL pipeline construction, is minimal compared to the number of jobs that would be produced by investing in large-scale wind and solar farms. And so the irony here, of course, is that going in that direction will produce far fewer jobs than investing in renewable energy, but it will greatly pad the profits of ExxonMobil and the Koch brothers, which is what this is really about. It's about the U.S. ultimately now becoming, there's no other word for it, a petrostate.
So given this scenario, they've pulled off this coup and we're about to have our, and it won't just be the fossil fuel company. I don't think he can bring back coal, even though he promised it, because Wall Street doesn't want anything to do with coal. But everything else will be gas and fracking will go crazy, oil will go crazy. But they'll also plunder the forests as well. The Koch brothers, of course, are on Georgia-Pacific, and people, if they buy brawny paper towels, are helping the devil.
Well, you know, there's an app you can
aid and comfort to the devil.
Products that are associated with the Koch brothers,
right?
Because it's hard to keep track of. Yeah,
it is. But I'm saying this is the last hurrah of the extraction industry. So here we are. We can't whine about this, Michael. We got to do something.
That's right. And, you know, it's easy, and I, you know, encounter a lot of people now who are extremely depressed because of what's happening, because of the dismantling of our climate policy. And they ask me, you know, how I can keep going, why I'm not depressed. And it is because of what we've already talked about. The world is moving ahead. There's nothing that is going to stop the transition to clean energy. It's the great revolution of this century, the great economic revolution of this century. So the question is simply whether the U.S. is going to get on board or get left behind. And we know what Trump wants. He wants us to get left behind while his, you know, friends and supporters profit greatly through, you know, as you describe it. This is what we're talking about, is a rear guard fossil fuel battle. It's the battle of the bulge. The fossil fuel industry is disappearing. It will disappear. That's clear. The question is simply, if we're going to allow fossil fuel interests to hijack our decision-making process in a way that lets them mine far more of the remaining reserves than otherwise would have been mined. Because keep in mind, there is five times as much fossil fuels in proven reserves right now as is necessary to warm the planet beyond the dangerous limit of 2 degrees Celsius, 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. Five times as much already exists in proven reserves. So if we allow them to tap those reserves, then we are committed to dangerous and irreversible climate change.
Well, Michael Mann, what is the, while others move ahead and we're trapped here with these reactionary, greedy, atavistic people who have pulled a massive con on the American people, do we have to get to the point where we're like the people in Beijing, where you can't even breathe? I mean, what kind of Pavlovian reaction are we going to have here to wake up?
Well, I think, unfortunately, we're going to see a red state, blue state divide here. We can look to California for an example of leadership on climate. And California is demonstrating not just to the rest of the country, but the rest of the world, how dramatically you can grow an economy if you commit fully to renewable energy, to solar and wind. And California is doing that, and they obviously have leadership in the form of Jerry Brown, the governor's office, and the state legislature. And it isn't just California. It's all of the West Coast states are part of a regional consortium that is committed to putting a price on carbon and incentivizing renewable energy. All of the New England states are part of a regional consortium. And if you actually total up the population of people who live in states that are part of one of those consortiums for pricing carbon, it's almost 30% of the population. So that's the point. We're going to see action at the local level, the municipal level, the state level, and as states group together. And as states group together, that forces large corporations to make decisions. Because if you can't make, automobiles that are sellable in California, you're going to lose out. So it forces automakers, it forces other manufacturers to respect the momentum that's present in the movements in some of the large states and some of the large cities. So I think what we're going to have to look for is grassroots upward approach to dealing with the problem rather than a top-down approach, because we don't have the leadership in the executive anymore, executive branch. We don't have leadership in our Congress. But what we do have is amazing momentum at the local level, at the state level. And that's a reason to hold out optimism, that we can still sort of keep things moving so that maybe 4 years from now, when there is a change in leadership, we'll be able to really hit the ground running. Right now it's about maintaining the momentum that is there and keeping it going so that hopefully in a more favorable environment a few years from now, we can then move full speed ahead.
So there's no point in holding out any hope that Trump, because he did have Al Gore visit him, and he also had Leo DiCaprio, who apparently used to date his daughter Ivanka, and it looks as if he was just using those people, just as he used the former Republican nominee.
I know both of those gentlemen. I know Leo quite well, and he has really committed himself to and I'm sure to him that's what it was about. I would guess that he didn't really think it was likely to make a difference, but if there was even the possibility of making a difference, he was going to do it. He was going to meet with Trump, and that's sort of the attitude that people have taken. Reason to not try every angle that's available, but I think you're right. I think to hold out hope that we'll see some late conversion, that we'll see some dramatic transformation. People have been telling us this now for how long, that what you see is what you get. There aren't any surprises here. The person that we saw on the campaign trail is the person who is in office and is going to govern the way that he has behaved in the past. And to expect otherwise would be foolish. So we have to focus our efforts, in my view, everywhere else and not hold out, not pin our hopes on the idea that Trump will somehow come through in the end, because I just don't see any evidence of that.
Well, Michael Mann, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's the co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And his latest book, with co-authored with the Washington Post cartoonist Tom Tolles, is The Madhouse Effect: How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back discussing whether Trump's America First agenda will bring back jobs.
Money makes the world go around. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound.
A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound
is all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanking sound
can make the world go round. Money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jared Bernstein, who's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He was a chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class and a member of President Obama's economic team. And prior to joining the Obama administration, he was a senior economist and director of the Living Standards Program at the Economic Policy Institute and held the post of deputy chief economist at the United States Department of Labor. He has an article at the New York Times, Ditching TPP Won't Solve the Trade Deficit. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jared Bernstein.
Thank you.
So today, Donald Trump signed an executive order withdrawing from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And in doing so, he promised great things for the American worker. He's also promised to impose tariffs on imports and crack down on American companies that manufacture overseas. Now, my question would be that tearing up these treaties like TPP and NAFTA, will they bring back jobs? And surely there are other factors beyond globalism, such as robotics and the use of and the rise of the dollar, for example, that are at play here.
Absolutely. I don't think tearing up trade agreements does much at all other than the optics. That said, I think that it's true that the trade agreements that we've been signing over the past couple of decades have very much had corporate interests at their heart. In a sense, they've just been rules of the road for the people who've been writing them, which has largely been, again, lobbyists from industry. So there are definitely ways in which those rules in the road could be more favorable to working people, consumers, and the environment. But simply ripping up trade agreements doesn't bring jobs back, no.
So why did two Democratic presidents, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, allow this to happen in terms of having, for example, a TPP was done in secret, which made a lot of people even more paranoid about its outcome? So why wasn't there an equal or at least more input from labor unions?
Well, there was very much a consensus, and I got to say that Donald Trump, for all of his extremely problematic qualities and characteristics, and believe me, they're deep, he did blow up this elite consensus held by Democrats and Republicans from the center-left to the center-right that globalization is either a pure good or that the downsides are minor and can be offset with a little bit of trade adjustment assistance or training in your next big trade deal. And in fact, while I believe, as I'm a card-carrying economist and a fan of globalization, while I believe that the net benefits from trade and globalization are positive, not just to us, but to many of our emerging trading partners, I also know for a fact that there are significant and lasting costs to large groups of people throughout the country. And we've certainly learned that in this recent campaign.
So what then can we make of Donald Trump? Because is it the same Donald Trump here at play who said that American workers are paid too much and that unions are responsible for jobs being outsourced abroad?
Yeah. You know, I think I can answer that in a pretty simple and coherent way, which is because I think I cracked this nut. I think I figured this out. Donald Trump, much like many other Republicans these days, but especially Donald Trump, is absolutely a master at politics, particularly a populist type of politics that tells voters what they want to hear. But when it comes to policy, to deliver on the promises inherent in those politics, he doesn't really know what to do. And I think that really explains a lot of what we're seeing right now.
And again, I'm speaking with Jared Bernstein, who's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He was a chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. And prior to joining the Obama administration, he was a senior economist and director of the Living Standards Program at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. And he also held the post of deputy chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor and has an article at the New York Times, Ditching TPP Won't Solve the Trade Deficit. But on the other side, you could make the argument that what he's doing, particularly with TPP, is in fact handing a gift to China. And on the basis of the very criticism that he's leveled against China, he said that China doesn't play by the rules. Well, my understanding that a big part of the TPP, apart from the trade aspects of it, was to organize the neighborhood into a trade organization that would force China to play by the rules. And we know China doesn't play by the rules. The entire UN ruled against them over their activities in the South China Sea with building military bases on these atolls and claiming this territory that doesn't belong to them. And China has just basically stiffed the global community. So it seems to me that you could make a case that Donald Trump is weakening America by simply handing the Asia Pacific to China. He's weakening Europe by undermining NATO.
Well, let me interject. I mean, don't conflate trade agreements with geopolitics and restructuring geopolitical relationships. Mm-hmm. I mean, trade agreements are, we freight these trade agreements up with much too much weight. Their advocates tell us that they're going to be a boon for every single economy in on the deal. Everybody wins, nobody loses. Their opponents say they're going to bring the economy to its knees. Their geopolitical advocates say this is going to freeze China out and make them behave. I mean, there's no piece of, even a 6,000-page 15-chapter trade agreement like the TPP, that's not what it does. Like I said, it has chapters on how investors will settle disputes. It has chapters on how we determine the rules of origins of the things we trade. It gets into environmental and labor. It's all of this legal, technical stuff about how countries trade. And frankly, that's not a bad thing to engage in. I think that rules of the road are useful in trading relations, but you have to be balanced as to who gets to write those rules.
But with the absence of the U.S. and the collapse of the TPP, won't China get to write the rules?
Well, China can certainly write the rules that it engages in with its trading partners through bilateral and multilateral trade agreements that it's already engaging in, one of which, by the way, is with us. There's this thing called the BIT, the Bilateral Investment Treaty, which is between us and China. So don't kid yourself. People are still making these deals. If Trump decides to, and he's actually making some sounds that he might decide to engage in some unilateral trade deals. That's what he said the other day. I never know quite what to make of the things he says, but he did say we're going to do some unilateral deals. Nobody's blocking any country from making trade deals with each other, and as I said, including us with China. So, you know, this is not nearly as cataclysmic as I think some of its of the TPP's advocates want to suggest.
Well, but you were in the Obama administration as Vice President Joe Biden's chief economic advisor, and you also were advisor on for the White House's economic. You were the executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class. So what was then the pivot to Asia about? I thought the TPP was the embodiment of Obama's pivot to Asia.
Well, first of all, it's pretty hard to pivot to Asia if you're trying to freeze out China, so I'm not sure that that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. China is kind of a big player in the Asian sphere. I think this was an agreement with the corporate America that we were going to try to pass another trade agreement, much in the spirit of my earlier comment. Remember, I asserted, and I stand by this, that most Democratic and Republican policymakers, especially from, say, the center-left to the center-right, I mean, you could always find people, you could find the people, a lot of Democrats for a long time have been hesitant to sign on to these deals, but at least from the center-left to the center-right, there was a belief that the more globalization, the better, the more trade, the better, and that trade deals are essential to increasing trade flows. Now, I don't think that's true. I think that conflates trade, globalization, and trade deals. Trade is not the same as trade deals. Don't conflate global trade flows with these rules of the road, you know, handshakes in the case of many of our trade deals between investors on both sides of the border. And in fact, I have a piece in the New York Times today where I argue that, I cite the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan group of economic analysts here in town, saying that, in fact, I'm paraphrasing, these trade deals have very little impact on trade balances, which is, I think, a pretty important insight.
Well, obviously, there's been pro-trade and anti-trade. There's been isolationists. There's the historical memory of Smoot-Hawley protectionism that accelerated the Great Global Depression. So I get the feeling, I've tried to navigate through this subject, and we're doing it now, and you're being very helpful because, frankly, it seems very tribal at times. You have the pro-trade and the anti-trade people, and you're dealing with a lot of dogma, and it's hard to get clarity here. So in general, trade is good, is it not?
Well, that's it's as I said a moment ago. If you talk, if your lens is the aggregate macroeconomy, then I think trade is a net plus. That is, by trading with other countries, we increase our supply chains, we deepen our connections in terms of the ability to get and sell the things we need. We provide emerging economies with an opportunity to trade with rich economies like ours, which is critically important for their economic development. So there are definitely many pluses, and in fact, net pluses. They outweigh the costs of increased global trade. However, for decades, I think policymakers had engaged in the analysis I just described to you and stopped there. They completely, or at least largely, disregarded swaths of people who said, this globalization thing isn't working out for me, for my family, for my community. We've lost our factories. We've lost our jobs. They've not been replaced by anything that's at all as beneficial to us in terms of value added, compensation, opportunity. And, you know, the answer of the global elites, both here and in other advanced economies, was, well, here's another trade deal for you. Completely unresponsive. So, yeah. So the answer is, if you ask me if trade is good, it's good for many, but it's bad for some. And you have to look at both sides.
Well, indeed. And looking at the side of the victims, the outsourced and the downsized, what do we do? I mean, you know, I mentioned earlier that robotics is also a part of it. There are other factors involved apart from handing the corporate global elite, you know, the keys to the car. So, I mean, it seems like that we have to be more imaginative now about how we create employment.
No kidding. I mean, the question you're asking is not a simple question. You know, there's no sentence that answers that question. I hope you realize that. Because we're talking about deep structural trends that have affected communities and economies for decades now. And you're right, it's not just globalization, it's also technological change. So the first thing we do is we make sure that there's a real safety net underneath these folks so that the income hit they take from job loss is seriously mitigated by a set of benefits and work supports that keep their living standards from tanking. Now, you may have heard the old saw, because people remember this all the time and from economics, which is we should continue trading as much as we can because the benefits from trade outweigh the costs, and the winners can compensate the losers. Okay? That's a very traditional thing that economists tell themselves, except for that last part never happens. So the first thing we're going to have to do is skim some of the benefits of globalization off and make sure that we have a real safety net for workers. But it can't just be a safety net. It also has to have a trampoline function to help people bounce back into economic opportunity. That involves training for new kinds of employment. It involves the intervention in currency markets when other, and you mentioned the dollar earlier, when other countries manipulate their currencies to increase our trade deficit against their trade surplus. We're going to have to engage in measures, that's what I wrote about in the Times today, to offset that so that our manufacturers are competing on a more level playing field. I think we may have to engage in some direct job creation to make sure that the labor demand is there. The Federal Reserve is going to have to play a role. I mean, this is an all-hands-on-deck kind of problem.
So in other words, just to sum up, so far it looks like the only people who benefited from globalism have been corporate America and Chinese peasants. And you're saying there's a whole bunch of people in the middle.
Oh, no. That is not at all what I'm saying. If that's what the impression I left, let me correct it. Because I tried to stress that, in fact, I think that the benefits have been deeper than that. So when you go to purchase something, whether it's a cell phone or a television or furniture or car, there's a very good chance that it's a lot more affordable to you because of the increase in the supply of goods, because of the supply chains that have been developed through globalization. So the consumer benefits are deep and pervasive. But at the same time, people are not just consumers, they're also workers. And in a minority of communities, not a majority, in a minority of communities, but not a trivial minority, a significant minority of communities throughout this country, the costs on the worker side have been, I think, serious.
Well, Jared Bernstein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, you're welcome.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Jared Bernstein, who's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 2009 to 2011, he was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. Prior to joining the Obama administration, he was a senior economist and director of the Living Standard Program at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., and also held the post of deputy chief economist at the United States Department of Labor. And he has an article at the New York Times, Ditching TPP Won't Solve the Trade Deficit. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about whether Donald Trump's decision to keep James Comey on as head of the FBI will mean that the investigation into his campaign and the Russians will go away. What have we done? How did we get so far from the sun? Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Colleen Rowley, a former FBI special agent who pushed to investigate the so-called 13th 9/11 hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui. And in 2002, she brought some of the pre-9/11 lapses to light and testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee about endemic problems facing the FBI and the intelligence community. Time magazine named her and two other whistleblowers Persons of the Year, and she retired from the FBI in 2004 and now speaks publicly on ethical decision-making and balancing civil liberties with a need for effective investigation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colleen Rowley.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And on the weekend, on Sunday, Donald Trump held a meeting in the Oval Office honoring law enforcement officials who provided security during the inauguration, and he called out Mr. Comey, the head of the FBI, and said, "Oh, there's Jim. He's become more famous than me." And Comey came over, and Trump gave him a big hug, patted him on the back, and whispered in his ear. And now we know, which is not a big surprise, that Trump is keeping Comey on. But there are some suspicions that the subtext here might be the reason he's keeping Comey on and the reason he put Pompeo at the CIA is that he wants friendly people to make sure that the investigation into possible Russian ties to his campaign go nowhere. So am I being too cynical here?
Well, there certainly could be that appearance. But, you know, one of the reasons I was not surprised when Trump decided to keep Comey on, and in fact, it's usual for presidents to keep an FBI director on because they go for a term of 10 years. Prior director Robert Mueller even lasted, I think, for nearly 12 years. And of course, you know, J. Edgar Hoover was 47. So this longevity for an FBI director is not unusual. But besides that, Comey, very much like Robert Mueller, is a quintessential Washington insider politician. And if you look at what happened in the lead up to the election, is he essentially walked a tightrope between the two-party partisanship. Initially, he was liked by the Democrats when he decided that the investigation of Hillary Clinton was to be terminated and announced that, and all of the Democrats applauded, so he was on their side. And the Trump campaign, of course, hated him at that point. They were calling him names and everything else. Then, 10 days before the election, he goes out and says he's reinstituted the investigation of Hillary Clinton, which really made all of the Democrats mad. In fact, Hillary Clinton blamed James Comey before they decided to blame the Russians for Hillary Clinton losing the election. She blamed James Comey for losing the election because he made this announcement. And of course, it was for naught. It didn't go anywhere. So if you look at how this has occurred, and then, of course, right now, this is even more important than the history, is that James Comey himself is under investigation by the Inspector General of the Department of Justice for his having done this, you know, unusual announcement 10 days before the election. And of course, as you just mentioned, the FBI is investigating possible ties of some of Trump's campaign people with Russian entities. So if you've ever seen, you know, when you talk about Machiavellian politics, I think Machiavelli himself would have a difficult time untangling the different leverages or potential leverages that could exist here. And to call James Comey damaged goods would be putting it lightly because of this history.
Well, a lot of the Democrats who went to the briefing that was held for House members that were cleared into the status of the investigations into the election, many of them leaving, including Congresswoman Maxine Waters, left in disgust, basically saying that Comey has no credibility. So how does he overcome that, or does he care?
You know, I don't think he necessarily has to care that much, at least for the short term. Obviously, an FBI director testifies fairly frequently to Congress, and most of the prior FBI directors have actually been held in high esteem. I would say not with complete justification for that, by the way, but Louis Freeh, you know, was treated as if he walked on water. And in fact, he did a lot of wrong things and made a lot of mistakes. But Mueller was the same way after 9/11. My memo was written, frankly, because all of the CIA and the FBI, 8.5 months after 9/11, there had been no information coming out how they had made these mistakes in lack of sharing of information. One of the reasons why Congress was not even grilling them properly was because of their reputations. George Tenet and Mueller had that same reputation as James Comey. And, you know, they're treated as icons, you know, as this, you know, our intelligence. They shouldn't be treated that way. I would frankly prefer to have, you know, if you think about the irony here, Trump was promising cleaning up Washington establishment, right? That's what, you know, the voters thought when they voted for Trump. They thought they would have these insiders essentially like Pompeo. These are all senators that are that Trump has nominated, or they're people like Comey that have really served in a variety of positions in Washington, or they're generals. And so what you're seeing right now is basically, to me, it seems like very much a repeat of putting Washington establishment insiders in these positions. I would frankly prefer to see some new faces, people with actually career integrity, more so than just this political establishment cred that people like Comey have. But I think that, frankly, with our Congress being kind of the same thing, they all voted to, they didn't all vote, by the way, to confirm Pompeo, but a large number of them did, including Democrats, even though Pompeo is saying he's open to torture. It's like, to me, the lessons, none of the lessons of the past 13, 14 years have really been taken into consideration by the Washington, D.C. establishment.
And again, I'm speaking with Colleen Rowley, a former FBI special agent who pushed to investigate the so-called 13th 9/11 hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui. And in 2002, she brought some of the pre-9/11 lapses to light and testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee about endemic problems facing the FBI and the intelligence community. Now, apparently, though, the investigation into possible collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians, or indeed the Kremlin, stems from a FISA warrant that was issued back in October. Supposedly it named Paul Manafort and Carter Page and Roger Stone, and may even have named Trump himself. And there's also, this is buttressed by intercepts from Estonian and Lithuanian intelligence. So at least in what reports have been leaked so far, there seems to be something to work on here. So do you think that there is enough nonpartisanship in the FBI to do a credible investigation here, given how Comey himself has become a lightning rod for accusations that he is a partisan Republican?
Well, even before this election, I predicted that we may see a constitutional crisis along the lines of Watergate. And this what you're describing, where you have a boss who is in, you know, has this entwinement, this historical, and now he's in the hierarchy under a president. You know, Nixon had to fire people that were not, you know, going along with him at the time. And so I think that is very much a likelihood. On the other hand, I just want to bring up an issue here, which is very valid, because when you have all this leaking of things like FISA, by the way, This knowledge that has apparently gone out to the reporters and to the media, and this isn't the only thing. There's been a whole series of top level, they're always described as anonymous top officials. and you know, that signals that these are not whistleblowers. These are essentially from the highest level, probably Obama, green-lighted or authorized these high-level leaks. And a leak of a FISA warrant is obviously, if this was an Edward Snowden or a Manning or a Colleen Rowley, they would be looking to catch that person and put them away for life, probably. So there's some real hypocrisy going on. I think the public really should demand more integrity, but it's just very, very difficult to know where to start at this point, because we have just let it go on too long and too far. But, you know, the FBI is the entity that would be investigating any possible collusion or ties. Obviously, public officials and business people do have all kinds of foreign ties. So you have to disentangle what is what they are, you know, people are allowed to have contacts and communications for business purposes and for even foreign policy purposes. It goes on at every level. And it's hard to disentangle that from something that would be a wrongful one on the part of anybody. I think there's an old law that's never really been. There's an old law. What is it called now? Oh, my gosh. Logan, the Logan Act.
Right.
And, you know, it's never been used. But if a nominee would be actually trying to orchestrate something, they say Nixon did this before he was elected, and that he postponed the Vietnam War, the end of the Vietnam War. Obviously, that would be terribly wrong, and certainly the FBI should be looking into it.
Well, it does seem that there is, when you explain that endemic, how leaking is endemic, Colleen Rowley, that would probably suggest that if there were an attempt to cover up or to stall or to stop the investigation, then somebody might leak it.
That's right. We might have another deep throat, another Mark Felt, who was, I think, number three in the FBI at the time. And, you know, someone crossed him or something, and he just decided to spill the beans. That's the danger. And I think that they have an insider threat program where they're trying to polygraph everyone in the intelligence agencies all the time and look at their personal lives, etc. I personally think that they're hurting themselves. The government is actually keeping good ideas and people from even voicing, you know, if they do witness, you know, a real fraud or a real illegal act. It's really counterproductive. And again, it's just, I think the real problem is here. We've gone up, let this go on too far and too long. We should have a much better workable government where people are doing the right things for the right reasons, and we don't have all of these really serious levels of endemic corruption that necessitate, once you get to this situation, unfortunately, it does necessitate an Edward Snowden. If you have top levels of directors that are willing to lie, and as you kind of mentioned, if Comey, for instance, was really going to do the wrong thing and try to cover up a really wrong collusion between Russia and Trump operatives, then I think it would be very, very justified for a new Mark Felt deep throat to arise and tell the truth. Just let me preface this, though. That Steele memo, which was the MI6 retired operative working for opposition research, that thing really smacked as almost a hoax. It seemed like double and triple hearsay. He had not been in Russia for 20 years, and I really don't think if the Steele memo is what people are talking about here, and a lot of the media still is. I think that really was doesn't look like it's based on anything.
Well, obviously, the U.S. has interfered in elections around the world, at least via the CIA. And in the Yeltsin years, after the fall of communism in Russia, the U.S. not only meddled in elections, it almost micromanaged the first elections there. So, but given that, though, there's still, I think, a difference between trying to affect an election outcome in the way that the intelligence community is accusing Putin and the Russians than the other examples. I mean, let me ask you, do you see a difference between what the U.S. has done and what Putin is accused of doing?
Actually, I am in disagreement here on this point, because most of the ICA, which was the three agencies, NSA, FBI, CIA, and as relayed by the National Director of Intelligence, Clapper, that ICA did not give any evidence of actual hacking. It almost veered off right into the what they call an influence campaign on the part of Russia. And they pointed to RT and other things, and they said, you know, they're trying to influence through wrong, you know, propaganda, essentially. That was the bulk of that ICA. And I do not see that at all coming up to the level of if what happened, which is on the cover of Time magazine, by the way, in I think 1997 or somewhere around then, with the cover of Yeltsin and this admitted meddling on the part of the United States. I'll just tell listeners that there's a really good interview by a Russian expert, journalist, by the way, who lived in Russia during this time period of the 90s. His name is Mark Ames. And if you look on the Empire Files interview of by Abby Martin of Mark Ames, this guy really knows that history. And it seems to me far more egregious than even what Putin is being accused of.
And Abby Martin's with RT, is she not?
I think that was 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And she now has some, you know, different journalists. No, she's long gone from that. In fact, right. that was, by the way, a funny thing in the ICA, they brought up some shows on RT that didn't even exist during the campaign. They had long been ended. So it just shows you how shoddy, I think it was kind of quickly done. They were under pressure to get this thing done, and they even have mistaken facts in their ICA.
Right. Well, I've spoken to Mark Ames a few times, and he's really good. I have a lot of respect for him. And I wanted to ask a broader question about what is the difference between meddling in our elections, as the CIA has done and as Putin's accused of doing, and the overall ongoing influence that foreign governments have in Washington. There's no secret that Israel has a lot of influence over the Congress, both on the Democratic and the Republican side. The ISI, the Pakistani intelligence, funnels money to Congress people. The Saudis buy all kinds of former government officials, et cetera, and so forth. So to your mind, what's the difference there?
Exactly. I think that the foreign lobbyists, and this is what George Washington warned against, these foreign lobbyists, we have a law, Foreign Agent Registration Act, and, you know, a lot of our congressmen, it's practically a revolving door, even some military generals. Why? Because they can get paid hundreds of thousands of dollars. One of the Podesta brothers was being paid $140,000 a month by Saudi Arabia. And so we have those registered agents that are all our top level, again, Washington, D.C., establishment insiders. And then on top of that, Israel, somehow, I think about 3 or 4 decades ago, somehow got out of having to register under AIPAC, and these other front groups for Israel don't even have to register as foreign agents. And so you have this huge amounts of money that are going into campaigns and whatever, far more, I think, far more dangerous and pernicious than anything I can even, you know, bring up here. I think we should deal with it. I really do. I think as a country, this is exactly what George Washington feared, with foreign countries having influence over our government. And yes, we should investigate every time there's a chance of that, or we hear about it. And I think that we've got some Machiavellian power politics taking place in Washington, taking priority over the good of the country.
Well, Colleen Rowley, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yes, thank you very much. Good night.
Good night. And again, I've been speaking with Colleen Rowley, who is a former FBI special agent who pushed to investigate the so-called 13th 9/11 hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui. And in 2002, she brought some of the pre-9/11 lapses to light and testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee about endemic problems facing the FBI and the intelligence community. Time magazine named her and two other whistleblowers persons of the year, and she retired from the FBI in 2004 and now speaks publicly on ethical decision-making and balancing civil liberties with the need for effective investigation. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.